Okay, everybody. Freilich and Zos Chanukah to you all. Hope everyone's doing well, relatively well. There's a lot going on in our world today. That's not a chiddush. It's not a nuance. Everybody knows that there's a lot going on. And at the same time, the things are cold up here and icy and wet. And there is a lot that is uncertain. In the last 24 hours, there's been a tremendous amount of rabbinic and social writing in the Jewish community on tonight's topic. And ironically, I laugh a little sometimes. We prepare in advance, and then we turn around and we discover, Baruch Hashem, sometimes we can use history as a guide and make Shiurim a little bit more interesting. Over the course of the beginning of the pandemic, we were meeting some of the great rabbinic personages who played important roles in dealing with pandemics at their time. And how they dealt with their own pandemics, I thought, gave a little flavor and excitement to what we might get and look to in our own time as we work through our own pandemic. And certainly from a personal level, I was very inspired by a lot of the rabbinic stuff that was out there. And I, as I've showed you on a number of occasions, I've really taken a interest in seeing what is out there in the current literature in both rabbinic and otherwise, just to give an extra reflection, perhaps helping me find my own footing while we're walking through, and sharing it with you makes it even more exciting. About 6 months ago, at the end of an article, Rabbi Dr. Eddie Reichman, who is the one of the deans up at associate deans up at Einstein, a tremendous doctor, but also a tremendous bioethicist and Talmud Chacham, parenthetically mentioned Waldemar Hafkin as a personality. And I put it on the side, left a thought in my head, gee, one day I want to figure out who this Waldemar guy was. And I realized that he's quite an unassuming profile for a person in this year slot. And yet, as we're spending time on Zos Chanukah, where we're dealing with some of the challenges of what Chanukah represents to us, which is Yafta Elokim LeYefes, Yishkon Be'or LeShem, the understanding that the beauty of Yefes, the science and the math and all the wonderful ideas of Mechkar are of Yefes, are most beautiful when they're inside the tent of Shem, in the tent of the his brother, the son of Noach, Shem. And certainly we're going to find that Waldemar Hafkin, otherwise known as Mordechai Zev Hafkin, is going to be an important representative of that idea. Who was he? Why is he so critical to us? Well, let's get started and figure out some of his background. He was born in Odessa in 1860. And he was known then as Vladimir Aronovich Mordechai Wolf Hafkin. He was the fourth of five children. He was born to Aaron and Rosalie in a family of Berdansk in the Russian Empire. The area is now known as the Ukraine. And he gets his education right there in Odessa and Berdansk, and ultimately in St. Petersburg as well. There is a discussion among the Jewish historians as to whether he actually got any cheder education at all. Maybe he did up to the age of seven, maybe not. His father clearly was not necessarily, how shall we say, most interested in Jewish education, and instead sent young Waldemar to gymnasium. In gymnasium, a lot more focus was placed on secular studies. And in the secular studies, Waldemar specializes in physics and math and in zoology. That's that Russian Ukrainian style that education is how you're going to get ahead. And the deeper the education, the deeper the study, the more science that you know, the better off you're going to be. And he does very well for himself. In 1879, he finds himself studying under the great Russian professor Ilya Mechnikov. And why is he studying under Mechnikov? Because he was recognized as somewhat of a zoological prodigy. He's writing articles already, and Mechnikov likes him. 1884. So Hafkin is also recognized as a member of something called the Jewish League for Self-Defense in Odessa. A major anti-Semitic episode takes place in 1884. There are a bunch of hooligans that are running through the town in Odessa. And they're walking, they pass Hafkin, and they tell Hafkin They're going to rough up the Jews, not recognizing that Hafkin was one of the Jews. And so he sees that they're about to destroy a Jewish home, and he beats up and gets into a certain fight with the hooligans. He wakes up in a hospital, and he discovers that he himself is chained to the bed because he was arrested. And it was determined that, you know, the problem was not the people who had started the pogrom. The problem was supposed to be him. And so he was arrested, and he was set aside to be very seriously punished. But Mechnikov comes to his defense, and he's let off and released. And so he continues studying with Mechnikov from 1879 until 1883. But when Tsar Alexander II is assassinated, then all of a sudden, if you remember, that's when in Russian history, that's when all the revolutions, the Bolshevik revolution, started up. And when we had all sorts of revolutions going on, the government becomes a lot more difficult with people that consider suspicious, including people in the realm of intelligentsia. You know, people who are very wise, etc. They were all of a sudden to be suspect of being against the government. Hafkin was working at the Zoological Museum in Odessa, and he's busy writing five important zoological monographs, translating some of them from and translating two from German into Russian. But they decide that since he's a Jew, he's an outsider. He therefore can never become a professor of zoology. So in 1888, he gets the following offer. If you renounce your Judaism, you can become a professor. If not, then you're stuck. You will never become a professor. And so here's Hafkin, who's not exactly what you would call the most identical. It's not like he's walking around with a Strimel and a long beard, but he refuses. He says, I'm a Jew. That's who I am. That's the way I go. And I will not renounce my Judaism. So he winds up stuck. He'll never, you know, at a dead end job, he feels the glass ceiling on top of him. And he decides that he has to get out of Russia. And so he asks to emigrate to Switzerland, and he makes it to Switzerland, and he starts working in the University of Geneva. And he first begins trying to grab whatever job. He's a Russian immigrant in the middle of Switzerland in Geneva. He needs some sort of place to work. And so he starts working as an assistant to Morris Schiff, Professor Morris Schiff, in the field of physiology. Let's watch that. Here's a guy who starts off with an expertise in physics and zoology. Now he's an assistant in physiology. He's got to be a pretty bright guy. He's a pretty serious person. And 1889, he gets the following offer. It's the golden opportunity of a lifetime. He gets an opportunity to join his old mentor, Mechnikov, who had already moved to France, and Mechnikov's new employer, whom you all might recognize as none other than Louis Pasteur in the Pasteur Institute. And they say, look, come with us, Hafkin, and we'll take care of you. So he gets to the Pasteur Institute in France, and he's looking around, and they say to him, well, we need an assistant librarian. You can work as an assistant librarian. So here's this guy who's giving up the opportunity to be an assistant professor, certainly gave up professorial rights, and all he's doing right now is sitting there as a librarian, eventually gets an assistantship, and he's working in the Pasteur Institute. Now, Pasteur never exactly fully accepts Hafkin. Put that on the side. So here's where we find Hafkin. Now, at the same point in time, one of the great cholera epidemics of the 19th century starts ravaging Asia and Europe. And in 1883, there was Robert Koch had discovered the description. He knew how to identify cholera, but they couldn't guarantee at that point in time that the identification was the sole cause of the disease. And as a result, the majority of the work of people who are working in the field of the sciences at the time is to discover some sort of cure for cholera. Sound pretty familiar and parallel to another point in time? Let's say, I don't know, a century and a little bit later? Well, Hafkin now starts working on his research to develop a cholera vaccine. And he produces an attenuated form of the bacterium. And everyone looks at his stuff, and you know what they say? We don't want to take it. Not enough drug trials. No chance. And so, So in 1892, on July 18th, Hafkin decides, I need a human test to show that, you know, this cure works. And so he gives himself the test. And on the 30th of July, he reports his findings to the Biological Society. And wow, the press is going crazy. We have a cure. Sound familiar? That being the case, there's a tremendous amount of excitement all over Europe because people are going wild. There's a cure. Hafkin found the cure. But here he is in the Pasteur Institute. And everyone says, well, we can't really accept it. Even Mechnikov and Pasteur and the official European medical establishment in France, Germany, and Russia, nobody's willing to put their stamp of approval on Hafkin's cure. So Hafkin says, okay, if you want trials, we'll do trials. He needs to find a place where he can go ahead and test the efficacy. Nobody wants to test it in Europe. So he says, you know what, I'm going to go to Siam. I'm going to go to Siam. I'm going to find quite a bit of cholera there, and I'm going to test it over there. And then you'll see what's going on, and hopefully enough people don't die within the process. But as he's getting ready to go, he hears that in India, which is a protectorate of which country? It's a colony of which country? The British. And so he hears that in India, they are suffering. And so he, through the influence of the Marquis of Dufferin, who was in Paris, serving as the British ambassador at the time, he goes to England and he demonstrates his ideas. And so the British government says, you know what, we could use you in India. And so he gets a commission to India and he gets to Calcutta in 1893. Now remember, this is a couple of months after he tests this thing on himself, and already he's off to India. And so he establishes a laboratory, and that laboratory still exists today in India. It's one of the most amazing institutes for bacteriology in the world today. It's known as the Hafkin Institute, after him. What was not as well known at the time, but important to parallel, because this is, after all, our Thursday night learning opportunity, is that as he's walking around setting up the Hafkin Institute to deal with the Indian public and the Indian population, Hafkin was also involved in setting up the schools in the yeshiva community. He sees the Jewish people and he gets involved in setting up the Agudah school and in visiting and taking care of the sick of the small Indian community who was identified as the B'nai Israel. He was very interested in trying to make sure that if he's a Jewish guy, he's going to have some relationship with the local Jewish community. Very different from his experiences in Europe to date, but this is Hafkin. And so Hafkin works on this plague. And by 1902 or 1903, 500,000 people were inoculated in that point in time. Now, that's incredible, considering the fact that he was a guy from England, who was really from France, who was really from Russia, who's now in India and didn't speak the language. So he had been accused in India of being a Russian spy. There were people who opposed his vaccine because they put it onto religious grounds. And all of a sudden, you know, Hafkin is responsible within 7 short years for bringing an inoculation to 500,000 people in India in the late 1800s. The numbers are astounding. They're incredible. But nothing is easy. And in August 1895, he had gotten very sick with a very high fever and a high infection. And so he was sent back to Europe. And reluctantly he goes, which at least gives him a chance at the halfway point to report on his medical findings. And in the British medical circles, as opposed to the Pasteur Institute, the people are walking around and saying, wow, this is incredible. Look what you've done. In 1896, he goes back to India. And when he lands in India, instead of winding up in Calcutta, they send him to Bombay. Why? Because in Bombay, they found that they had a brand new problem. Not nearly the same as the cholera epidemic. This time it was the problem of the bubonic plague. And so Hafkin comes along and he establishes a lab in Bombay. And he is a full-fledged tyrant. That is to say, he sees himself on a mission. And while he's on his mission, Yeah, while he's on his mission, he cannot do anything else. He doesn't want to stop. He doesn't want to eat. He doesn't want to sleep. His entire lab is him and three assistants, and they're working 12 to 14 hours a day so seriously that one of his assistants has a nervous breakdown and two of the other ones just quit. But Hafkin was a guy who had an incredible drive. And so by 1897, he had a form of a vaccine that was ready for human trials. And surprise of surprises, he has a problem. And if I asked you what the problem was, you would say, who wants to go first? Who's going to allow himself to be subjected to a vaccine? And so Hafkin says, if somebody's got to get the vaccine first, it might as well be me. And so Hafkin's vaccine uses a very small amount of the bacteria to produce this immune reaction. And he takes it himself on January 10th, 1897. And after the results are announced to the authorities, this time he finds a population that's willing to do this to not suffer from the evil effects of the bubonic plague. Where do you find a willing population? In the prisons, because that's where people were suffering. And so in the prisons, the Baikula jail, Hafkin gives the volunteers his vaccine, and all of them survive the epidemic except for seven inmates in a control group. As Hafkin says, like others of those early vaccines, he said he did recognize that the formulation had some nasty side effects, but it reduced risk for up to 50%. Still, people said, well, we don't really need your vaccine, because what we can really do is engage in something else to protect from the bubonic plague, sanitarianism, which means what? We'll wash our homes by fire hose with lime. We'll deal with people who are suspected into camps and hospitals, and we'll restrict travel, and we'll be able to cover all the problems, and we won't have a problem anymore. And of course, you know how well that works, Bisman Azeh, because it did wonders back then. And of course, applying that here, we can't just sit here, and Hafkin recognizes you can't just sit with a bubonic plague or a cholera epidemic and just shut down everybody you suspect of having a problem. And so therefore he did something about it. In 1898, the Russians, who never wanted to give him the professorial opportunities in the past, they come to India to learn from him, but they don't want to respect his conclusions. This leads Hafkin to write in one of his diaries, the Russian government would rather let the farmers die than recognize that they were going to be saved by a Jew. And once again, Hafkin's Judaism comes into play when he deals with his science as well. You know, for the first couple of times, we find Hafkin talking about keeping Shabbos. Not in Paris, not in London, not in Russia, not in the Ukraine. When he's in Bombay, we see that he is keeping Shabbos. We find that he becomes influenced by another individual, seems to be a rabbinic personage of some sort, David Sasson. And David Sasson spends time with him every afternoon so that he should have some downtime just honestly learning, which later turns out to have a very profound impact on Hafkin, which I think we'll get to in a couple of minutes. In 1902, March 1902, 19 Indian villagers from Mokowal in Punjab all come in for an inoculation. All of them die. All of them got tetanus. 88 other people who had come for the same vaccination the same day, they were all okay. And so they did a whole investigation to figure out what happened with this group. And they figured out that there was a contamination of one bottle, and the sterilization was not done properly. And guess who got blamed? Hafkin. And so Hafkin, this led to a commission from the Indian government. And the Indian government blames and indicts Hafkin. And so, eager to protect their own, the British government brings Hafkin home, and the report becomes known as the Little Dreyfus Affair. After all, there was a smell that there was a lot of anti-Semitism in this situation. The Lister Institute comes along and reinvestigates the claim and overrules the verdict because they figured out that Afghan had nothing to do with the situation. Do you know why 19 Indian villagers died? They died because the assistant who was giving the vaccination used a dirty bottle cap that had fallen on the floor and should have been sterilized before it was put back in. It wasn't. That's why the people died. Nothing to do with Afghan. And the only reason this verdict gets overturned is because of the efforts of Ronald Ross, a Nobel laureate. And Afghan winds up exonerated in 1907. But by that point in time, it was too late. He lost his position in Bombay. It was given to somebody else. And so he goes to Calcutta and he works there until he retires in 1915. Of course, at the onset of World War I, he does volunteer to serve to help out with some of the British soldiers in the war, but he never really goes back to work anymore. This is the medical story of Waldemar Hafkin. But the best part of the story of Waldemar Hafkin, our profile in the pandemic, is not necessarily in the story, but rather, as Dr. Wenger likes to say, it's in the rest of the story and in the connections. You see, aside from being Waldemar Hafkin, Hafkin is also Mordechai Zev Hafkin. Mordechai Zev Hafkin winds up having a very strong connection to the Jewish community. In 1898, he had approached Aga Khan III to go to the Turkish Sultan Abdul Hamid II to try to get him to resettle Jews in Palestine. And he says, look, to be quite honest, we'll purchase the land and the capital would be provided by the wealthier members of the Jewish community in Europe. And wouldn't this be great? And so here we find Hafkin, who's not even a Frum guy in 1898. He's first getting into his Frumkeit. And here he is, and he's presenting his Zionist ideas to be able to go ahead and bring the Zionist community together. And we find that, you know, in his lifetime, he, especially towards the second half of his life, he's donating a tremendous amount of money to Torah learning. He believed that there is a tremendous amount of learning to be found. And he starts to develop, because he is such a well-known personality as a result of his vaccines and his scientific discoveries, he starts talking out a little bit more. In 1916, Hafkin prints a small monograph. Here's a copy of it. It's printed in English. It's called A Plea for Orthodoxy. What an incredible idea. Some guy is sitting somewhere and he's writing a plea for orthodoxy. And in it, he makes a strong case for the bonds of religion that keep people together for something greater than the people themselves. He talks about kashrus and how kashrus has an ability to keep us together and healthier. He talks about the value of us having a common language of distinctive dress and how all of these things work to preserve ancestral ties. He's impressed with a religion that encourages youth to defer to the wisdom of the forefathers and of using a modern science and reconciling it with what he calls the Adon Olam. He says these things are all important components of having a prosperous and orderly life. If I may quote, And I think that there's a comment I just want to make in that regard. A brotherhood built up of racial ties, long tradition, common suffering, faith and hope is a union ready-made, differing from artificial unions in that the bonds existing between the members contain an added promise of duration and utility. Such a union takes many centuries to form and is a power for good, the neglect or disuse of which is as much an injury to humanity as the removal of an important limb is to an individual. No law of nature operates with more fatality and precision than the law according to which those communities survive in the strife for existence that conform the nearest to the Jewish teachings or the relation of man to his creator, on ordering of time for work and rest, on the formulation of families and the duties of husbands and wife, parents and children, on the paramount obligations of truthfulness and justice between neighbor and neighbor, and to the stranger within the gates. Hafkin basically turns around and says, take a look. When you're sitting in our world and you want to figure out how civilizations survive. The civilizations that survive, survive because of their commitment to orthodoxy. And where was this monograph printed, my dear Dr. Wenger? It appeared in a journal in April 1916 in something called the Menorah Journal. The Menorah Journal on the 8th day of Hanukkah proves what, my dear Dr. Wenger?
It's all connected.
It's all connected. The Menorah Journal, Hafkin, everything comes together. And this is pretty much the way Hafkin goes on from 1916 till the end of his life. He lives at this point in time, not on the central stage of medical science and medical breakthrough. He had done his time there. Oh, he became and amassed quite a bit of wealth. But during this last number of years, the last 15 years of his life, Hafkin spends most of his time becoming very close with the Orthodox Jewish community. He puts on tefillin every day. He spends time learning. And he becomes very involved with the yeshivos, not necessarily where he lived in Western Europe, but more in Eastern Europe. In fact, in 1929, he establishes something he calls the Hafkin Foundation. And what's the goal of the Hafkin Foundation? It's to foster Jewish education in Eastern Europe. He was respectful of other religions, and he considered it the utmost importance to study the Bible, this from a guy who's a scientist, right? But he sets up and realizes that the survival of our people, the survival of civilization, as he had written in 1916, is based on having a good, solid connection to a past. In fact, Hafkin sets up $300,000 in a Swiss bank account. $300,000 in 1929, by modern standards, is millions. No? Devorah shaking her head, yes. Right? And he sets this up for European yeshivos. And he turns to the head of Eastern European Jewry at the time, Rav Chaim Ozer Grzesinski, and he asks him to be the head of this Hafkin Foundation, at least to handle the disbursements. Rav Chaim Ozer is bowled over by the distribution request. He can't believe it. I mean, the yeshivas in Eastern Europe were suffering. The Rosh Yeshivas couldn't get out of Europe to go to the United States or other places in Western Europe to go raise money. And now all of a sudden, like manna from heaven, $300,000 is there to be divvied up. At the meeting that they were introduced to this special group, Rav Chaim Ozer gets up and he identifies Hafkin, a man he never met. And he says, the man is clearly a tzaddik. The man must have been a tzaddik. And then he stops and he says, actually, he's a tzaddik and a chacham. Because he was not just a tzaddik, he was a tremendously wise individual. He knew a tremendous amount and still through it all found God in the process and valued Torah Hashem as an ideal that far surpassed any of his accomplishments. And he says, such a person is a tzaddik and a chacham. But he has to deal with certain questions. Question number one that Reb Chaim Ozer has to answer is, when we disperse the funds, do we disperse the funds now, take the $300,000 and just disperse it among the different groups? Or do we turn around and we put it in a bank and live off the interest and divvy up the interest? This is a major debate because a lot of the, had they chosen to wait, the many of the yeshivas that would have benefited from some of the portion of the money would have had to close. You know, all the yeshivas were suffering at that point in time. So Reb Chaim Ozer makes the decision, Reb Chaim Ozer makes the decision to disperse the funds now and to make sure that the funds get used at this point in time now. That wound up being a very, very sagacious decision because within a couple of years, by 1932-33, the banks were seizing people's personal funds. And so by definition, having had the chance to utilize them, save the yeshivas at that point in time from having crushing, crushing debt that they had no means of paying for. And so again, Hafkin's money and his trust in the Chachamim certainly helped out in the situation. Question number two became a lot more important within the system. And what was question number two? Question number two was, how do we figure out what to do? How do we handle the situation that comes up when there are different yeshivas in Eastern Europe? We know there was a Slabodka, and we know that there was a Radin, and we know that there were certain well-known single yeshivas. But in the inside Russia and on the Polish-Russian border, there was a huge system of yeshivas known as the Navardic yeshiva system. Literally, they were spreading from place to place, place to place. And the question came up, are all Navardic yeshivas just branches of one yeshiva? Or are we to see them as multiple yeshivas entitled to separate, apportionments, right, from this money or not? So how do we figure out the answer? And so here they're sitting in Reb Chaim Ozer's, shtut in his town, and they're trying to debate the issue. And Reb Chaim Ozer says, I have to exclude myself. I can't decide the issue on my own. And all the Rosh Yeshivas start debating with each other. Why not? What's the matter? He says, I'm a member of the Vada Yeshivas. I'm a Nogeya Badavar. I know everybody's problems, and I can't make the decision. So the people of the Rosh Yeshiva says, what are we going to do? How are we going to figure it out? He says, just wait a minute. The door opens and a younger fellow steps into the room and sits down. And they said, this fellow is Avram Yeshaya. And he is the person I've asked to come in and adjudicate the party. Who is Avram Yeshaya? Avram Yeshaya was the youngest member of Reb Chaim Ozer Grzanski's court. He was known as the famous Rabbi Avram Yeshaya Karelitz, otherwise known as the Chazon Ish. And this was one of the first instances where we find the Chazon Ish's mindset and his great involvement being taken and utilized for the sake of Klal Yisrael. The decision that the Chazon Ish decides is that he decides that actually Nevardik is three major branches. And so they were entitled to three separate apportionments of the Hafkin money, but not hundreds of apportionments. This is Waldemar Chaim Zev Hafkin. Chaim Zev Hafkin, what do we learn from him? Lesson number one, we learn to be involved in the world. We know that when Yaakov Avinu comes back to the land of Israel, he finds himself outside of the city of Shechem, and Vayichan es Pnei Ha'ir. He goes ahead and he faces the city. And Rashi tells us that that Yaakov Avinu got involved in the needs of the city. Mordechai Zev Hafkin also got involved in the needs of the world. Jews have such a responsibility. We have a responsibility to be nosei ba'ol, to deal with the matters of the world. And Chaim Zev Hafkin, an individual who understood the world of bacteriology and the world of immunology, he made it his business to share and to make sure that he would do what he could for the benefit of the world. But through it all, in the same way that Yaakov Avinu was es Pnei Ha'ir, he made sure to understand and not assimilate, but rather join. Chaim Zev Hafkin, perhaps not necessarily from his own choice, is also never allowed to assimilate, and later turns around and never wants to assimilate. And this becomes an important lesson, especially during the Yamim Ha'im Bazman Hazeh, when so much of Jewish tradition at the period of Bayis Sheni was very much about assimilation. We read in last week that the intermarriage rate that was pressured became something that was so terrorizing during the period of the Hashmonaim. Mordechai Zev Hafkin turns around and teaches us you don't have to assimilate in order to accommodate. And we can learn from that, especially in a time of a pandemic. And yet at the same time, very often when we are looking at science, we tend to look at science as something that exists independent of Torah life. Mordechai Zev Hafkin turns around and teaches us the exact opposite. Use your science as a means to appreciate the Adon Olam. Use the lessons of science. I had the zchus in my life to meet many different scientists. And the one who most openly made this clear was the late Professor Hermann Brandhofer, who was a Russian physicist who was close to the Rabbi Herschel Billet, the rabbi of the Young Israel Woodmere, who just retired. And I remember he brought Professor Brandhofer to speak in the shul when I was a young kid. I don't remember most of what Brandhofer spoke about, but I'll remember one line for the rest of my life. Branov returned and said to us, I never understood how a person can be a scientist and be an atheist. I can't understand it because a person needs to come up with an understanding and an appreciation that if you study Torah Hashem and you study the world of Hashem, you'll realize the Torah is the blueprint to understand that world. How could you see anything else? One of the lessons of being illuminated of through the light of Hanukkah is that lesson of Mordechai Zev. We're talking a lot about vaccines today. Maybe in Mirtz Hashem next week, one of the topics we'll take up in our regular Chalent Chabura slot will be some of those issues of vaccination in our world today. One of the things that we can take away from a man who was the last, who went through the last major period of pandemic, global pandemic, and looked to solve the crisis, is to remember that above everything else, when you solve a crisis by getting rid of a problem, by solving a problem, you've solved a problem and a crisis. But when you carry it steps further and bring it closer to Hashem, you haven't just gotten back to the reset button. You've moved onward and upward. And with God's help, that's what we'll get out of our pandemic as well, an opportunity to move onward and upward and appreciate the amazing Hashgachas Hashem, the amazing involvement that God has in our world. If we grab that opportunity, we too will become those who will gain and be illuminated in the process. I thank you all very much. And I wish you all a Zos Chanukah Sameach. And Be'ezras Hashem, next week, we will come back to some of the big questions of the day. Shabbat Shalom to all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.